Chapter 20. Leave that brooch as a pledge. I don't say no. Yes, of course, you can get it back when you bring me my money. On the way home, she felt an immense and unexpected quietude. It had been horrible to have to leave Harney's gift in the woman's hands, but even at that price the news she brought away had not been too dearly bought. She sat with half-closed eyes as the train rushed through the familiar landscape. And now the memories of her former journey, instead of flying before her like dead leaves, seemed to be ripening in her blood like sleeping grain. She would never again know what it was to feel herself alone. Everything seemed to have grown suddenly clear and simple. She no longer had any difficulty in picturing herself as Harney's wife now that she was the mother of his child. And compared to her sovereign right, Annabel Belch's claim seemed no more than a girl's sentimental fancy. That evening, at the gate of the Red House, she found Eli waiting in the dusk. Was down at the post office just as they were closing up, and Will Target said there was a letter for you, so I brought it. Eli held out the letter, looking at Charity with piercing sympathy. Since the scene of the torn blouse there had been a new and fearful admiration in the eyes she bent on her friend. Charity snatched the letter with a laugh. H, thank you, good night, she called out over her shoulder as she ran up the path. If S.E. had lingered a moment, she knew she would have had Eli at her heels. She hurried upstairs and felt her way into her dark room. Her hands trembled as she groped for the matches, and lit her candle, and the flap of the envelope was so closely stuck that S.E. had to find her scissors and slit it open. At length she read, Dear Charity, I have your letter, and it touches me more than I can say. Won't you trust me, in return, to do my best? There are things it is hard to explain, much less to justify. But your generosity makes everything easier. All I can do now is to thank you from my soul for understanding. Your telling me that you wanted me to do right has helped me beyond expression. If ever there is a hope of realizing what we dreamed of, you will see me back on the instant, and I haven't yet lost that hope. She read the letter with a rush. Then she went over and over it, each time more slowly and painstakingly. It was so beautifully expressed that she found it almost as difficult to understand as the gentleman's explanation of the Bible pictures at Nettleton. But gradually she became aware that the gist of its meaning lay in the last few words. If ever there is a hope of realizing what we dreamed of. But then he wasn't even sure of that. She understood now that every word and every reticence was an avowal of Annabel Belch's prior claim. It was true that he was engaged to her, and that he had not yet found a way of breaking his engagement. As she read the letter over, Charity understood what it must have cost him to write it. He was not trying to evade an importunate claim. He was honestly and contritely struggling between opposing duties. She did not even reproach him in her thoughts for having concealed from her that he was not free. She could not see anything more reprehensible in his conduct than in her own. From the first, S.E. had needed him more than he had wanted her, and the power that had swept them together had been as far beyond resistance as a great gale loosening the leaves of the forest. Only, there stood between them, fixed and upright in the general upheaval, the indestructible figure of Annabel Belch. Face to face with his admission of the fact, she sat staring at the letter. A cold tremor ran over her, and the hard sobs struggled up into her throat and shook her from head to foot. For a while she was caught and tossed on great waves of anguish that left her hardly conscious of anything but the blind struggle against their assaults. Then, little by little, she began to relive, with a dreadful poignancy, each separate stage of her poor romance. Foolish things she had said came back to her, gay answers Harney had made, his first kiss in the darkness between the fireworks, their choosing the blue brooch together, the way he had teased her about the letters S.E. had dropped in her flight from the evangelist. All these memories, and a thousand others, hummed through her brain till his nearness grew so vivid that she felt his fingers in her hair, and his warm breath on her cheek as he bent her head back like a flower. These things were hers. They had passed into her blood, and become a part of her. They were building the child in her womb. It was impossible to tear asunder strands of life so interwoven. The conviction gradually strengthened her, and she began to form in her mind the first words of the letter she meant to write to Arnie. She wanted to write it at once, and with feverish hands she began to rummage in her drawer for a sheet of letter paper. But there was none left. She must go downstairs to get it. S.E. had a superstitious feeling that the letter must be written on the instant, that setting down her secret in words would bring her reassurance and safety, and taking up her candle she went down to Mr. Royal's office. At that hour she was not likely to find him there. He had probably had his supper and walked over to Carrick Fry's. She pushed open the door of the unlit room, and the light of her lifted candle fell on his figure, seated in the darkness in his high back chair. His arms lay along the arms of the chair, and his head was bent a little, but he lifted it quickly as Charity entered. She started back as their eyes met, remembering that her own were red with weeping, and that her face was livid with the fatigue and emotion of her journey. But it was too late to escape, and she stood and looked at him in silence. He had risen from his chair, and came toward her with outstretched hands. The gesture was so unexpected, that she let him take her hands in his and they stood thus, without speaking, till Mr. Royal said gravely, "Charity, was you looking for me?" She freed herself abruptly and fell back. No, she set down the candle on his desk. Wanted some letter paper, that's all. His face contracted, and the bushy brows jutted forward over his eyes. Without answering, he opened the drawer of the desk, took out a sheet of paper and an envelope, and pushed them toward her. "Oh, you want a stamp too?" he asked. She nodded, and he gave her the stamp. As he did, so she felt that he was looking at her intently, and she knew that the candlelight flickering upon her white face must be distorting her swollen features and exaggerating the dark rings about her eyes. She snatched up the paper, her reassurance dissolving under his pitiless gaze, in which he seemed to read the grim perception of her state, and the ironic recollection of the day when, in that very room, he had offered to compel Arnie to marry her. His look seemed to say that he knew as he had taken the paper to write to her lover, who had left her as he had warned her she would be left. She remembered the scorn with which as he had turned from him that day, and knew, if he guessed the truth, what a list of old scores it must settle. She turned and fled upstairs. But when she got back to her room, all the words that had been waiting had vanished. If she could have gone to Arnie, it would have been different. She would only have had to show herself to let his memory speak for her. But as he had no money left, and there was no one from whom she could have borrowed enough for such a journey, there was nothing to do but to write and await his reply. For a long time she sat bent above the blank page, but she found nothing to say that really expressed what she was feeling. Arnie had written that as he had made it easier for him, and she was glad it was so. She did not want to make things hard. She knew as he had it in her power to do that. She held his fate in her hands. All as he had to do was to tell him the truth, but that was the very fact that held her back. Her 5 minutes face to face with Mr. Royal had stripped her of her last illusion and brought her back to North Dormer's point of view. Distinctly and pitilessly there rose before her the fate of the girl who was married to make things right. As he had seen too many village love stories end in that way. Poor Rose Cole's miserable marriage was of the number, and what good had come of it for her, or for Alston Skeff? They had hated each other from the day the minister married them, and whenever old Mrs. Skeff had a fancy to humiliate her daughter-in-law, as he had only to say, "Oh, I'd ever think the baby's only two? And for a 7 months child ain't it a wonder what a size he is?" North Dormer had treasures of indulgence for brands in the burning, but only derision for those who succeeded in getting snatched from it. and Charity had always understood Julia Ha's refusal to be snatched. Only was there no alternative but Julia's. Her soul recoiled from the vision of the white-faced woman among the plush sofas and gilt frames. In the established order of things as she knew them, she saw no place for her individual adventure. She sat in her chair without undressing till faint gray streaks began to divide the black slats of the shutters. Then she stood up, and pushed them open, letting in the light. The coming of a new day brought a sharper consciousness of ineluctable reality, and with it a sense of the need of action. She looked at herself in the glass, and saw her face, white in the autumn dawn, with pinched cheeks and dark ringed eyes, and all the marks of her state that she herself would never have noticed, but that Dr. Merkel's diagnosis had made plain to her. She could not hope that those signs would escape the watchful village. Even before her figure lost its shape, she knew her face would betray her. Leaning from her window, she looked out on the dark and empty scene. The Ashen houses with shuttered windows, the gray road climbing the slope to the hemlock belt above the cemetery, and the heavy mass of the mountain black against a rainy sky. To the east, a space of light was broadening above the forest, but over that also the clouds hung. Slowly her gaze traveled across the fields to the rugged curve of the hills. As he had looked out so often on that lifeless circle, and wondered if anything could ever happen to anyone who was enclosed in it. Almost without conscious thought, her decision had been reached. As her eyes had followed the circle of the hills, her mind had also traveled the old round. She supposed it was something in her blood that made the mountain the only answer to her questioning, the inevitable escape from all that hemmed her in and beset her. At any rate, it began to loom against the rainy dawn, and the longer she looked at it, the more clearly she understood that now at last she was really going there. XVI, the rain held off, and an hour later, when she started, wild gleams of sunlight were blowing across the fields. After Harney's departure, S.E. had returned her bicycle to its owner at Creston, and she was not sure of being able to walk all the way to the mountain. The deserted house was on the road, but the idea of spending the night there was unendurable, and she meant to try to push on to Amblin, where she could sleep under a woodshed, if her strength should fail her. Her preparations had been made with quiet forethought. Before starting, S.E. had forced herself to swallow a glass of milk, and eat a piece of bread. And S.E. had put in her canvas satchel a little packet of the chocolate that Harney always carried in his bicycle bag. She wanted above all to keep up her strength, and reach her destination without attracting notice. Mile by mile she retraced the road over which S.E. had so often flown to her lover. When she reached the turn, where the wood road branched off from the Creston Highway, she remembered the gospel tent long since folded up and transplanted, and her start of involuntary terror when the fat evangelist had said, "Your Savior knows everything. Come and confess your guilt." There was no sense of guilt in her now, but only a desperate desire to defend her secret from irreverent eyes, and begin life again among people to whom the harsh code of the village was unknown. The impulse did not shape itself in thought. She only knew she must save her baby, and hide herself with it somewhere, where no one would ever come to trouble them. She walked on and on, growing more heavy-footed as the day advanced. It seemed a cruel chance that compelled her to retrace every step of the way to the deserted house, and when she came in sight of the orchard, and the silver-gray roof slanting crookedly through the laden branches, her strength failed her, and she sat down by the roadside. She sat there a long time, trying to gather the courage to start again, and walk past the broken gate, and the untrimmed rose bushes strung with scarlet hips. A few drops of rain were falling, and she thought of the warm evenings when she and Harney had sat embraced in the shadowy room, and the noise of summer showers on the roof had rustled through their kisses. At length she understood that if... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.